Hi, this is Zach Gershberg for Know Your Media on KISU. I'm excited today to be joined for this month's episode with Rachel Martin, co-host of Morning Edition for NPR News. Rachel happens to be from Idaho Falls and a graduate of Idaho Falls High School. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Go Tigers! You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Well, that's great. So we're nearing the end of the calendar year, and we're in the middle of an impeachment, and it's so exciting to talk to you. You seem to be at the center of the maelstrom, so to speak, having just interviewed, among other individuals, Joe Biden, who's running for president. First, I would say, how are you holding up within all this chaos?
I wish I could say, well, it's because I get 8 hours of sleep a night. But that is definitely not the case. you know, I guess I will respond to that by saying it's just history, right? Like, this is just such a huge and important story that even on those days when something can feel very incremental or, you know, you get in this vortex where you feel like, oh, it's not making a difference and it's washing over people and people are just numb to the news and have kind of anesthetized themselves to it because of the deluge.
Right.
You take a step back and then you remember that it really does matter to people and to the moment. So that keeps you going.
Sure. It feels as though this is a big historical moment in some ways with the ongoing impeachment inquiry. But also, I think what has come to a head, as you know firsthand, is this sort of division between politics and media and journalism. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious, as someone who's devoted their life to this, does it become a little bit dispiriting at all? Or what do you do to keep your head up?
Well, I will say Twitter adds a whole other dimension to it as well, because
sure.
Twitter is not representative of the American public, but there are a lot of vocal critics on there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get it from all sides. And I would say that it is dispiriting in that often in the debates we're having right now, whether it's about the origins of the Russia probe, Russian interference in the United States elections, people don't agree on the basic facts, and things are so fragmented in media that people can go to a website or an online magazine or just follow a particular influencer in their ideological spectrum and think that it's fact, the stuff that outlet right. or that person is spewing. And that's not journalism. I mean, it's just not. And of course, all of this is made even more complicated by the fact that it's the president of the United States who is eroding the public's trust in the media. And it makes things all the more difficult because we're not supposed to be part of the story, right? Like, that's not what we do. And it's increasingly difficult to stay out of it when the president and a lot of his allies, not everyone, but oftentimes when you're interviewing supporters of the president, they want to flip the script, draw you personally into the conversation, and litigate the fairness or objectivity or perceived
sure.
bias of the media. And that makes things difficult at times. Mm-hmm.
And something, you know, at least I try to do in our courses here at Idaho State University is kind of distinguishing between transparency and bias. Mm-hmm. I always think transparency is the more important variable because that's about the reporting that you actually do, whereas bias is something just, you know, alleged before the fact or after the fact, mm-hmm. but transparency is what creates the fact itself. And I'm just curious if you get exhausted with these conversations of bias or if you see the relationship between transparency and bias at all different.
No, I think it's important. I think it's an important conversation to have. Because, and I like that you draw that distinction in your teaching. Because I think it is ridiculous to suggest that people who happen to be journalists and have chosen this line of work don't have bias. We just do. We're people. We have a set of life experiences that have shaped us. And while we are continuously trying to account for that in how we approach stories, how we write stories, how we frame stories, how we parse words, it's so granular how we try to account for our own personal biases. It shows up in story selection, what we think is important to cover as opposed to what we don't. And
yes.
I think that the best way to manage that is to be as transparent as possible.
Sure.
You mentioned the interview that we did with Joe Biden on Friday, and mm-hmm. what aired on Morning Edition today is an abbreviated version of that, 11 minutes or so. And then we do a digital piece. But then we also release a video online of the entire interview. Mm-hmm. And I think whenever we can, especially with bigger newsmaker interviews like that, it behooves us to release the whole kit and caboodle, just so people
sure.
can see what happened. You can draw your own conclusions. You can come to me for my sort of curated tour of that conversation, because
right.
hopefully you trust me to give you an accurate depiction of what transpired. But at the same time, we'll give you the thing unvarnished and you can draw your own conclusions.
Sure. And we're here again with Rachel Martin, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, who is from Idaho Falls. Speaking to that, I guess I just have to ask, because I did see one of the video clips. What was it like to have a candidate for the president of the United States wag his finger in your face?
It wasn't the most enjoyable moment, I have to say. It's not just any presidential candidate. He's the former vice president of the United States. But he's a public official, and you're granted an interview. And what comes with that is the ability to ask the questions that you see fit. And he chose to engage on that question in a certain way. He didn't appreciate the question, took real umbrage to the question, and
sure.
so expressed that physically with a little finger wag. But it was tight quarters, so we were sitting very close together on this bench, which made it all the more intense, I will say.
Yeah, it was a closed shot.
It was a closed shot, yes.
Well, I found it kind of interesting, not just because it was slightly confrontational on his end, but I thought you were trying to press him on civility, and it seemed as though he was unable or unwilling to own that he was acting in an uncivil manner at this town hall meeting, whereas on the other side, we see President Trump, who at the very least owns that he's an uncivil sort of figure. But it almost struck me as Joe Biden trying to have it both ways. That was my impression.
He is trying to look forward. He's trying to presume a mm-hmm. nomination and look forward to what he hopes is a one-on-one between him and President Trump. And I'm sure his campaign is trying to prep him for that standoff. And I think Joe Biden and many in his camp believe that you meet the president where he is rhetorically. And
sure.
that will go over with some voters. Many people saw that exchange he had with that mm-hmm. person in New Hampton, Iowa, who stood up and started making false allegations at him about Ukraine and his son, Hunter. And Biden looks at him and says, "You're a damn liar," and then challenges him to push-ups and IQ tests. And they saw that and they said, "Yeah, go, Joe. That's what we want. We want a fighter." But at the same time, as I put out there in my interview with the former vice president, there were people who didn't like it, who thought that it looked petty,
right.
that he was sinking to Trump's level. And so it's a matter of style,
sure.
and what people are going to think is Joe Biden fighting back or imitating Donald Trump.
And sometimes that's such a great point, because the term bias, which has a legacy going back to Marshall McLuhan and his mentor Harold Innes, bias referred to the style of media technology more than anything. And I've always been struck with public radio on the one hand, always tries, even in a heated political discussion, to affect a more cordial conversation. But on the other end of the radio spectrum, literally, we have partisan talk radio. And I always find it interesting that some of the research suggests how NPR tends to be one of the top sources for information literacy. But on the other hand, you have, at least for the last 30 some odd years, this really powerful, persuasive use of the radio medium. And I'm just kind of curious if you could speak about radio itself and what function it has kind of in our media landscape that includes social networking and traditional television and newspapers and magazines and the online world.
Hmm. Well, obviously public radio inhabits such a unique space, right? And now there are a lot of derivatives in the form of audio podcasting and people using audio as a platform for their own journalism. But it's true. I mean, this is our thing. Our thing is civil conversation. And it is not meant to be an echo chamber. It is not meant to reinforce your own preconceptions or your own political beliefs, which is what the other side of the radio dial often often traffics in. And it gets people really heated, right? That kind of partisan talk. And you feel validated. You have a sense of emotion around that. You can feel angry. And those are motivating emotions. That affect people in a very real way. And that's just not what we're about. There's plenty of storytelling in public radio that moves you and that elicits emotion. But especially in our news coverage and of this political moment, that's not what we're here to do. You can draw your own conclusions, and that may involve some kind of emotive response to it. But our job is to lay out, as best we are able, the facts of a particular issue and to characterize as best we are able the different perceptions of these issues and then have constructive conversation around them. We approach every interview. You have to have respect for the person you're talking to. And that is difficult a lot of times. Mm-hmm. But if you have made the decision that this person is worth hearing from, then you must approach that conversation with the notion that this is someone who deserves respect in this conversation. It doesn't mean you can't challenge them. In fact, that's exactly what we're there to do, is to challenge any kind of obfuscation, any kind of intentional misstatement or lie, and call it out as such when we hear it. But you can do that in a dispassionate way. And that is what public media has always been about, in public radio in particular. It is more difficult than ever to do that in this moment, but I think we do a pretty good job.
Do you get concerned thinking about the future of public media and the support for it, or do you feel pretty confident?
You know, I actually don't. I mean, I get down from time to time when you look at social media in particular and the vitriol that can come out from that corner of the internet. But then you talk to people out in the world and even polling. I mean, NPR remains one of the most trusted brands in America and one of the most trusted media outlets, often at the top of that list. While the loudest critics may be out there on Twitter or Facebook or writing in comments, it's the vast majority of Americans of any political persuasion who turn on NPR and rely on NPR to give them a sense of reality. You know, they can go to other places to get a particular frame or get a point of view, but we're the touchstone. We're the place where you can understand the lay of the land, and then you can go elsewhere to furnish your own opinions based on what others spin out.
So again, we're speaking with Rachel Martin, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. And speaking of those different places, I did want to ask you, because you've worked for NPR for some time now, but I know in your career, after getting an undergraduate degree at the University of Puget Sound and then a master's at Columbia University, you did have a stint with ABC News. And I'm kind of curious if there You can speak to any differences structurally or personally with working for a commercial network versus NPR, mm-hmm. or if they were kind of similar in some ways?
I will start off by saying I was very glad to be able to have that experience, because you don't know, and this is no affront to my friends and former colleagues at ABC or in television news, because there are amazing, amazing journalists in that world who are doing real public service journalism and holding people to account right now, and we are better for it. But it was important for me to have that experience so I could value to an even larger degree what we do in public radio. First and foremost, we just have more time. I mean, I was the weekend White House correspondent for ABC News, and I was lucky if I got 90 seconds for a news story. And that is just insufficient to talk about complicated White House decisions, foreign policy, things that were happening on Capitol Hill. All of that was in my bailiwick. And there's just not enough time to get to any nuance. And so what I came to understand about that medium, which another colleague here at NPR, Deb Amos, who actually had spent time at ABC, told me when I went to go work there, it's like news haiku working in TV. You're trying to create an impression more than you are trying to explain a complicated issue. It was almost like you seize on a headline and then you just repeat it for about 90 seconds with visuals. And that can be very compelling, but there's an opportunity cost there, right? Because you've decided this is the most important idea and we're going to nail it for 90 seconds, but there's just so much that's left out of that.
Sure.
And the other thing is the intimacy of radio. And the images are so powerful in television, and it really can draw people in like nothing else, a particular image. And stories lend themselves to TV. Mass disasters, crime often, things that play well in pictures that really give you a sense of the story. But for anything that requires nuance, there's just nothing like radio or audio in particular. It is so much more intimate. People are seizing on the words that are being said. They're not distracted by the pictures. They're listening. And I think it can be so much more powerful. And it requires the audience to engage. It's not passive. You have to use your imagination. Right. You have to engage in the idea that's being laid out. And for me, there's just nothing like it.
Thank you. That's a great response. And it really speaks to this notion that radio is a hot medium. And in some ways, that intimacy, that vibe that it puts off, where it's not just, the cool procession of images creating an impression, I think also speaks to how radio has survived the rise of television in the mid-20th century, as well as the rise of the internet and satellite radio, which I always continued to think that AM/FM radio would go away, but somehow it has managed to sustain itself with news. I know there's more than just news on the radio spectrum, but I've always found that rather interesting in some ways. I do want to ask. There's a lot of talk of fake news, and it feels as though each side politically blames the other side of being brainwashed and allegations of bias. But I am curious from your perspective, whether is our cultural problem one of credulity, where we believe too much false stuff, or is our problem maybe of incredulity, where we can just so easily dismiss important information, even if we acknowledge it. And so this is everything from politics, presidential politics, to global warming, to trade issues, to education issues. And I'm just curious, is there a problem that we're too easily led to believe things that aren't true, or that we don't accept and then discuss the things that are true?
Well, I'll tell you what, I think there's so much information out there. I think people aren't taking their responsibility as an informed citizen seriously. And I don't mean to be overly critical, but it really is incumbent on individuals to stay informed and to question things. I'm not suggesting that you only listen to NPR. Far from it. People need to read. We need an education system that promotes civic understanding, just the basics even of how our government works, but also, I mean, you teach media literacy. That is something that should be taught in every single high school as a requirement to graduate, in my opinion, because it's more important than ever, because the responsibility is greater. The onus is larger now for the individual to make sure that they are doing their due diligence to find out the facts of something. And I sympathize with that because it's a lot, and people have lives and they're raising families and they're working two jobs, and it's a lot to try to parse what's coming at you. You know, I understand that it can feel overwhelming and you can dismiss it with whatever you heard last night on some opposing television channel. I guess I would just respond by saying it's just too dangerous to do that. Take the time to read things. Take the time to solicit information from a variety of news sources. Get a multifaceted news diet in your life.
So speaking of that, what is Rachel Martin's media diet?
Oh, now you're going to call me out.
Listening to your employer. I'm curious in terms of newspapers, magazines, online sources, social networking. What do you enjoy, or what do you enjoy to be informed with as well?
So I have to read all the basics, right? The New York Times, the Washington Post. I also check in. But this is how real people do it. I read the front page online of the newspapers where my siblings live. you know, Denver and Portland, Oregon, respectively. Check out the Idaho Falls Post Register every once in a while.
Oh, great. Okay.
Because it just gives you a sense of what other people are absorbing, right? And then I follow individual writers. I mean, and this is going to be an annoying answer, but because I'm in this world and I know a lot of writers and reporters and investigative journalists in particular, I follow individuals as much as I've been maligning Twitter. Twitter's a great place to follow people who I know do good work, and then I just read whatever they're doing. And in podcasts, my hat's off to my colleagues at the New York Times. I think The Daily is excellent, created and produced by the excellent Theo Balcom, who is an alum of NPR. You know, I find it to be a great companion to our podcast, Up First, which is the top three. Look at me plugging myself. The top three stories you need to know in the day. And then The Daily is a longer, more narrative, long form on one issue. And I just think they do great work. And then just a variety of other podcasts. I listen to Mike Pesca, who hosts The Gist on Slate, Preet Bharara. His podcast is excellent, especially in this moment when you're thinking about impeachment. You know, I would just say follow what you like, follow people you like, but just make sure you're listening, reading, watching a variety of different things.
So now that we have what Rachel Martin's media diet, can you speak to our audience here in southeastern Idaho what a young Rachel Martin's media diet was attending
awful.
Idaho Falls High School?
Okay. I mean, a little bit. I listened to Z103. I don't even know if that was the name of the station. Z103 Radio in Idaho Falls. So let's see. On the news and information front, my parents got a subscription to The Economist. So actually, read a lot of The Economist growing up. I don't want to give the impression that I was like reading it when I'm 9 or 10 years old. But in high school, that's what I would pick up. We actually didn't listen to NPR in my household. It just wasn't a thing my parents grew up with. And so it wasn't anything I was exposed to until I went to college. But in my house, we watched, you know, the evening news on television and the local newspaper, the Wall Street Journal. My dad used to read the Wall Street Journal a lot, and I read The Economist.
No, that's great. So, I mean, I'm curious, were you interested in journalism when you were attending Idaho Falls High School or the University of Puget Sound, or was this something you came to a little bit later?
I sort of came to it later. I thought I was going to be a lawyer. My dad's a lawyer, and I majored in political science in undergraduate with a concentration in international affairs. I think because I hadn't seen very much of the world, I was just curious about it. and so journalism sort of came later to me. I was never the editor of a newspaper or even the yearbook. I didn't work at a college radio station. or work for a college paper. It happened for me after I had lived abroad after college. I lived in Japan for a couple of years, moved to San Francisco, worked for a nonprofit, started listening religiously to the NPR station in San Francisco. And okay. at the same time, I was taking the LSATs. And I really just didn't enjoy that experience. And the idea of applying to law school just wasn't motivating me in that moment. And I had some friends and colleagues who said, what else do you want to do? And I'm like, well, in the back of my mind, there was always this journalism thing. And so kind of on a whim, I applied for an internship at the NPR station in San Francisco. Did it for virtually nothing and then could not imagine doing anything else. Like the idea of brandishing a microphone and people telling me things and having these intimate conversations about issues that matter in the world, I was totally hooked.
Has a lot changed since going from being a foreign correspondent? I know you were a correspondent for religion, I believe, for a little while, and now you, you know, serve as co-host of Morning Edition. Has that been a shift for you? Professionally, a big change or something you're completely comfortable with?
There's lots of shifts in that, right? I decided not too long after I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan immediately after the U.S. invasion, or not immediately after, but a couple years after. 2003, I was there as a freelancer and dipped in and out of there for the next 3 years or so, and then went back covering it as a Pentagon reporter. But I knew fairly early on in that experience that I was never going to be a lifelong foreign correspondent. It's really isolating work. And I just knew that I wanted more of a collaborative environment for journalism for me. And so that's just an automatic switch. I'm not living in the far reaches of the globe. But the transition from reporter or correspondent to host is pretty different. Our bread and butter is the interview. And so I don't get as many opportunities to do writing and really laying out a story. Instead, it's the concentration on what happens between two people in conversation and that dynamic, sure. that give and take. And I love that. That was always the best part for me about reporting in general was that exchange, the interview. And because it's organic, you can go in with a plan and something happens and now you're off in a different territory. And how do you get it back? Or maybe you want to stay over there. Who knows? And there's something really live and exciting about that. And so that's what I get to do as a host. It changes the kinds of questions that you ask because your purpose is different. You're not going back and editing this thing and carefully crafting it into a story. It's right now. It's the urgency of what is going to be said in this moment and what question am I going to ask in what precise way that's going to elicit a certain response. And that for me is almost intoxicating. I love that challenge.
Well, it's certainly from our vantage point here in southeastern Idaho, really fascinating to see. I mean, just in the last week, you interviewed a leading presidential candidate, Joe Biden, as well as a law professor, Jonathan Turley, who testified to Congress. And it's really remarkable, and we hope you continue to be a sort of fan favorite here between Idaho Falls and Pocatello. And we really want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And wish you a happy holidays. Is there anything, any last sort of comment you have for those of us here in
just
Idaho
that
or maybe?
Idaho! I have so many things to say. We do a whole other interview about the ways that my upbringing in Idaho shaped who I am. People in Idaho are the best. We are often maligned out there in the rest of America, and especially on the East Coast. And I welcome any opportunity to correct stereotypes. I mean, people from Idaho are hardworking, intellectually curious, kind people with a strong sense of their own history. They're just the best. And I had such a great experience growing up in Idaho Falls. My family's five generations from that state. So I feel a real, real connection to the place and the land. And I go back as often as I can.
We want to wish you well and thank you for joining us. And we'll have to have you on again for a totally Idaho-themed
show.
Totally.
I welcome it. Let me know.
Rachel Martin, co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, thank you so much for joining us on KISU's Know Your Media. We really appreciate it.
Oh, Zach, thank you so much and happy holidays to you.